Morning. Well, quite a few of you braved the elements to make it. Well, the wind out there right now is really blowing. So this morning, I was going to, I live only four blocks from here, but I didn't want to, I had to give the talk. So I called a cab last night because I thought I won't be able to get out of my driveway in my alley. Then I woke up at 7 a.m., and I thought, oh, I saw only 3.9 inches of snow. No big deal. So I canceled the cab, got in my car, and my car is stuck in the alley by my garage. I walked. That's my story. I don't know what your stories are, but Minnesota stories, like in the old days. For those of you who lived in Minnesota in the old days, we had these, our whole winter was nothing but this, like this before climate change. So this morning, I want to talk about the paramitas, the paramitas are generosity, morality, patience, effort, meditation, and wisdom. And conventionally, the conventional word that's used in relation to the paramitas is the perfections. But being a Zen guy, that word I consider to be totally inadequate. Instead, I go with the etymological origin of paramita, which is the gone beyonds. The gone beyonds. So the gone beyond perfection or imperfection. You know, we want to be perfect. We want to get away from imperfection. We say, oh, we're imperfect. We'll never be perfect. We're gone beyond. So I think of them as a way to cut through, to deconstruct and demolish all of our conceptual frameworks, our ideas, our belief systems, our reference points, in other words, to pull the rug out from under us, which sounds maybe interesting at first, but when it happens to you, it ain't that interesting. But ultimately, it's the door into freedom. It's the door into freedom. So the Prajnaparamita texts, earliest Mahayana texts, which differentiates Mahayana from its predecessors, Paramita texts are the gone beyond texts. And there are the 30,000 lines, 20,000 lines, there's the Diamond Sutra, and there's the Heart Sutra that I have been chanting here 6 days a week for, I guess since 1975, I was gone for a few years, but throughout Zen centers all over the world, that's what they're chanting, the shortest Prajnaparamita text, the shortest gone beyond. And supposedly, when Buddha gave his talk about the gone beyonds, now don't forget, but I gotta clarify this, those Prajnaparamita texts were hidden for 500 years in the cave of the Nagas. In the serpent's cave. Buddha gave those talks during his life, but then people weren't ready for them, so they got hidden. And 500 years later, they got discovered. And so we have this new movement within Buddhism called the Mahayana Buddhism. Mahayana, the big vehicle, based on the discovery of these. So supposedly, when he talked about them, senior practitioners who had been hanging out with him for a long time, people who wanted to be arhats and others who thought they were arhats and were wanting to move from the conditioned to the unconditioned, were wanting to move from deluded to enlightenment, listened to all this gobbledygook of the Prajnaparamitas, and they said, this is crazy. We're out of here. And they all took off. Now, they didn't all take off. A group of them stayed, but some of them had heart attacks. Some of them vomited blood and died on the spot. That's why we call it the Heart Attack Sutra. Now, you guys don't get heart attacks when you read that sutra because you didn't learn Buddhist catechism. If you were steeped in Buddhist catechism and had spent your whole life learning about this is the way to practice, this is the way to be, this is how you're mindful, this is how you take care of yourself, take care of others. And then all of a sudden, somebody came along and negated all that. You might have a heart attack too. And if you really read the sutra, you see how it's a very linear negation of all Buddhist catechism up until that time. Now, I think so. I think so. Yeah. From that point of view, I think of the paramitas that way. That instead of dichotomous thinking, which kicks out the opposite pole, we get one-sided stuck on generosity, morality, patience, effort, meditation, wisdom, and we shrivel up when we get these ideas in our head about how we should be. Instead of that, notice how we get caught on all this dichotomous thinking, and go deeper and open to something quiet in here that's joyous and that isn't caught by that stuff. A mind unburdened by thought. That's really what the Prajnaparamita Sutras are about and what the Heart Sutra is about. Although it does seem really weird if you don't understand that it's just a deconstruction. Think about your Protestant or Catholic upbringing, and when you're maybe 30 years old, all of a sudden everything got deconstructed, and the minister came in and said, "Well, that's one's wrong, that one's wrong, that one's wrong, that one's wrong, that one's wrong." Hmm? I didn't go through that because I was raised Unitarian, you know, but many of my friends could have it. So, dichotomous thought, thinking in opposites, it's a central thought distortion that human beings have, and what are the ramifications socially right now? Well, a couple of ramifications socially right now. Gender. Oh, we thought gender was a nice little polarity, didn't we? But we've been removing the straitjackets of masculinity and femininity and discovering, nuance, gradation, change, not masculine, feminine. What about race? Race. Black and white. But there's no biological races. They were invented by the slaveholders. Black and white was, you know, other cultures. But white people invented this black and white dichotomy. Who wanted to justify owning slaves. Interesting, huh? Interesting. So, my great-great-grandfather Timothy came from Ireland during the potato famine, and he landed in New York. I don't know. He was illiterate and impoverished. I don't know how he got to New York. But once he got to New York, he had to sleep outside. He was black Irish. The black Irish were not allowed inside. They worked in the stables. They slept outside. He heard there was a part of the continent he could go to where he could be white, where he wouldn't be black anymore. So somehow he got to California, where he wasn't black anymore. And so he sent So all the rest of my relatives came. They all stayed there except me. So that's interesting, isn't it? We get caught on these dichotomies, and then we feel divided from our deepest selves and divided from each other. And that's what the paramitas are meant to be, a corrective to that. Corrective. So now I'm going to talk about the six paramitas. There are actually 10, and in much Mahayana there are 10, but these are the 6 primary ones. I'm going to talk about them from the conventional point of view, and then also from the gone beyond point of view, which is not gone beyond to something out there, it's just gone beyond to here, where we're not caught by these all these different ideas and thoughts, and the emotional stickiness that's involved in these thoughts. So the first one is generosity, dana. Dana. Conventionally, we have the bodhisattva, and we try to help other people, and that's wonderful. But generosity needs to expand beyond that. It needs to include generosity toward ourselves. I would say that I have met with many, many people here over the last 15 or 20 years. Actually, I used to do it. Many, many people. And so many people forget about being generous to themselves, how important that is. Well, how can you really be generous in your heart of hearts to someone else if you're not generous to yourself. And unfortunately, the scriptures don't talk about that, but the Tim scripture talks about that. Generous to yourself so you can be generous to others. Well, that's the first way in which I like to expand the conventional thought about generosity. The second one is from the Diamond Sutra. So the two shorter of the Prajnaparamitas are the Diamond Sutra and the Heart Sutra. The Diamond Sutra. So Buddha says in the Diamond Sutra, Subhuti, if bodhisattvas act generously without concepts of generosity, their merit will be incalculable. Without concepts of generosity. Instead of thinking, I'm practicing, I'm going to get initiated, or I'm not going to get initiated, I should be more generous. Well, notice that should. Does that should, an open should? Is it a should where you feel connected to everyone, or whether you're trying to get away from what is, and you're imprisoning yourself in that should? So be careful of that concept. It's a powerful concept. You should be generous. Where does that come from? Where does that come from? Is it in your heart? Is it in your soul of souls? Or does it come from something your mama told you to be good, to be liked by other people? No, just notice that. Because if you want to move beyond that limitation, right? Beyond that limitation. So if we're moving beyond that limitation by being generous to ourselves and then not shooting ourselves to death, then how about moving beyond to including stinginess? Stinginess. Where does material stinginess come from? Emotional stinginess, mostly? Doesn't it? When all we've been exposed to is stingy behavior, then we feel normal. It's normal. It's not possible to know what we're missing when we don't even know what is missing. The males in my family, that was mostly what I was exposed to, and they were my role models. So when I began hanging out with my teacher, I began seeing a different way of being, a different way of being. I began seeing how my own stinginess came from emotional stinginess, which had been passed on to me by the males in my family. Not to label any of them, but well, I have not labeled them, but enough of that for now. I grew up in Palo Alto, and my teacher wanted me to open a sitting group there, and I opened a sitting group in Palo Alto, and his idea to come down every week from San Francisco to lead the sitting group and give a little talk. So after about five or six times, when he was out of the room, I said, well, let's pass the plate to the people, the Donna bowl, the generosity bowl, to people who were in the room. And then after they left and I was going home with him, I said, look, this money shows shows how much we value your being here. And he said, oh, thank you, but that money should be for you. He said, you're the one who organized all this. You're the one who set it out. You're the one who found the house. He said, all I did was show up. And, you know, here I am. My dad's sending me to Stanford, you guys. So my dad is paying for me to go to Stanford. My teacher is eating day-old vegetables in San Francisco. That's once I pass him on the street with his grocery bag, and he said, look, only one day old. And I went, oof. So, and I felt that was not a should, that he really wanted to share with, he really wanted the money to go to me for my effort. And I was deeply moved by that, because I was not used to that, that came out of his core of his being, not out of some idea about how he should be. So then, when Zen Center wanted to buy Tassajara, immediately I gave money. I had never done that before. But you know, when someone is generous to you, you ever notice that? How you just want to give? Because we're not used to that. I mean, if they're generous from their heart of hearts, not from just a should. So, that happens. That happens. And can we learn to be generous to our stinginess? Oh, we're all stingy sometimes. Can we be generous to it? Can we practice seeing it? Practice seeing its roots and embracing, touching the fear that's underneath? Why were all these men in my family, including me, why were we stingy? Because we were afraid. We were afraid. That's why we were stingy. If we had just a little more stuff, you know, we'd be okay. We'd be okay. And why were we emotionally stingy? Because somehow we felt like if we gave our heart away, we'd lose our heart too. But this practice is about seeing those things and just not being preyed on by them. Those impulses, those sort of negative thinking and the emotion that goes along with it. So that's giving. That's generosity. The next one, Shila, morality. Morality. So at the same time in my life when I was a young man, I lived with my girlfriend in San Francisco. And after we'd been living together, my girlfriend, now my wife. I live with my girlfriend in San Francisco. And after we'd been living together, we got kicked out of the apartment because the landlady said she had a nephew who Linda and I thought was a hood, because he drove a motorcycle and wore a black jacket and had one of these chains he carried around all the time. She said that she was afraid we would corrupt the morals of her nephew by living together. You know, you guys don't remember. Most of you are too young. You don't remember what it was like 50 years ago. Even in San Francisco, it was considered immoral for people to live together when they were not married. Linda and I were doing something immoral, so immoral that we got kicked out on the street. We had to find, the only place in San Francisco we could find back then, maybe this is 55 years ago, I don't know, was a black part of San Francisco. And they would let us, they didn't have this thing. So we lived in a black part. It was really, really quite wonderful. Anyway, so morality is a social code. Well, okay, but social codes are always changing. So please don't get sort of intoxicated by the current social code. It has to be something deeper than that, don't you think? My teacher once gave a talk about morality, and he talked about the precept, you know, these are the norms for behavior that we have. The precept, do not sell liquor. And he said, yes, this is an important one, do not sell liquor. And he said, and the same goes for Buddhist teaching. It could be very intoxicating liquor, so do not sell it. And he said, I hope I am not selling you liquor. I don't want to sell you any liquor. But I can't help it if you decide to drink what I'm teaching you. But I'm teaching you this so you can sober up and enjoy your life and not be addicted to my teaching, right? Not be addicted to some idea about the paramitas, some idea about generosity or morality to try to be good. So you can be more alive in your world, more engaged, find a deep, deep pleasure in just being, just being. Yeah, on the other hand, morality is important in a way, isn't it? But a big morality, not a little social idea of morality. We need to be kind to each other. We need to be thoughtful. We need to be supportive of each other. Look at all the teachers and priests and ministers who've abused their power sexually. God, doesn't it gross you out? I mean, it grosses me out. And Zen teachers aren't any better. They're any better. Yucca. Yucca. What happened? What happened? Well, my teacher said, there are no enlightened people. There's only enlightened activity. So don't put anybody on a pedestal. Don't. That person feels like they're on a pedestal, and then they have some need or want, and they take advantage of it. So how can we act in an enlightened way as much as possible? In a way when we're just engaged with each other. We're not trying to use each other or get power over each other or even teach each other. We're just being. Just being, that's all. Just being with each other. How can we do that? Go beyond the split of morality and immorality to deep feeling of heart connection with whatever, with just this. Then that is morality, but as soon as it's an idea of morality that you get attached to, then you want to kick the rest of the world out. And then you divide it up. And of course, dividing up is good too. We need to divide up, but we can divide up without getting caught by it, don't you think? So the next one is patience. Ksanti. Patience. And as many of you know, I didn't realize this until a few months ago when I started talking about a turtle, but I guess the turtle is my power animal. And I have turtles. People have given me turtles. I have a lot of turtles. Patience. The turtle. The hare, there's a turtle and a hare both in the backyard. I've seen two turtles in the backyard since I've been coming here in 1975. They're not too often, but two of them. And a lot of bunnies. A lot of bunnies. Gazillion bunnies. The turtle and the hare. They both want to go to Bede Makaska. They both want to go there. They're in the backyard. They want to make it to Bede Makaska. In my first talk this morning, I couldn't pronounce Bede Makaska, but someone came over to me afterwards and said, "Well, I'll tell you how to pronounce it. Just think about a bidet, and then think about Makaska." And I said, "Oh, okay. I'll probably never mispronounce it again." Anyway. They both want to get to Bede Makaska. But the turtle just takes one step, just takes another step, goes back in its shell, takes another step. The hare races down the Bede Makaska. Not the lake it wanted it to be, so hare has to race around Bede Makaska. Still doesn't feel right. Race over to Lake of the Isles. Maybe that'll be the real lake, the unconditioned lake. The enlightened lake. Oh, no, that ain't good enough. Rush up to Lake Harriet. Poor hare. Turtle just... in the shell. Right? Who's the winner? Who's the winner? Turtle practice. Rumi says... Oh, the turtle... People say, oh, the turtle is stupid. The turtle has no goal. Turtle has a goal. Turtle has a goal. Here's what Rumi says. Patience is not sitting and waiting, says Rumi. It is looking at the thorn and seeing the rose, looking at the night and seeing the day. Lovers are patient and know that the moon needs time to become full. Lovers are patient and know that the moon needs time to become full. Turtle practice. Turtle practice. And that means also being patient with our impatience. Being patient with our impatience. We're all impatient sometime. I'm impatient sometime. Oh, we're impatient. Can we be patient with our impatience? Where does our impatience come? It's because of desire. If it's a wholesome desire, I think impatience is natural. So we don't kick that out. It's natural. If it's a wholesome desire, I don't get to see my grandsons until April 19, and I'm impatient. They're growing up. They grow up really fast. I'm impatient. I want to see them. But that's fine. That's a healthy desire. So I can be patient with my impatience. It's natural, right? Talk to them on the phone, whether I can. Although this is getting older, they're less interested in talking to grandpa on the phone. You know, they're getting into adolescence, and pretty soon they ain't going to be interested in grandpa at all. But that's just the way it goes. That's one reason I'm impatient. But I can just see that and know that that's a healthy desire to be connected, to be with them because I love them. And then the unhealthy desires sometimes. We have unhealthy desires, unwholesome desires. Buddhists use the word wholesome rather than healthy. Unwholesome desires. So I just go into an unwholesome desire. I feel it. I feel the suffering underneath it. It's because I'm suffering. I'm afraid. Or it's because I'm needy or wanting. So I just be with it. I'm patient with my impatience about getting that unhealthy desire. And if I'm really with it, that unhealthy desire kind of shrivels on the vine. And then it comes up again. But then it shrivels on the vine with my patience with it, with my openness to it. Because it's part of being human. It's part of being alive. Because the unconditioned world is the conditioned. Because the enlightened world is the deluded world. So the next one is effort. The fourth one is effort. Effort. Well, if Zen school, we're the Soto Zen school of Buddhism, so effort. That's what my teacher always emphasized. You just make your effort on this moment. You don't worry about anything else. You just extend yourself to this activity. If you're cutting the carrots, you just cut the carrots. If you're hanging out for someone with tea, you just visit with them, listen to them, and if you're, you know, doing whatever you're doing, you just engage. Don't worry so much about before and after. Just engage in this activity. You can fully engage in almost any activity. And that's it. Making effort. That's Soto Zen, actually. Shikan Taza says just to sit. Just sitting in meditation. But actually, my teacher said, no, not Shikan Taza. Shikan everything. You know, just to wash the dishes, just to walk your car, just to... And then my teacher once was sitting and reading a newspaper and drinking tea and talking to someone. And one of his students said to him, well, I thought you said just to drink tea or just to read the newspaper or just to talk to someone. He said, yes, just read the newspaper, drink tea, and talk to someone. So we get stuck. We're dichotomous. We want the one true way. So then our teacher reminds us, oh, this is the one true way already. It includes all the ways, right? So effort. Enlightened activity is effort. You don't have to have an enlightenment experience. Anytime you're just with something without the screen of judgment and evaluation preying on you, that's enlightenment already. It's already enlightenment. So what about, since we're doing the paramita, what about effortlessness? Well, effort and effortlessness, not different. Not different. When you look at the turtle in the backyard, is the turtle making effort or is it effortless? If you really watch that turtle, I used to have turtles when I was a kid, too. Yes, we had a little... Yes, but of course I grew up in California where we could let our turtles out. Anyway, I had turtles when I was a kid. I got off what I was supposed to talk about. I enjoyed those turtles when I was a kid. Just as I enjoy the turtles on my altar right now. So effortless. The turtle, is the turtle making effort or not? Doesn't know. It doesn't know. It's just doing what it's doing. when we really give ourselves to something, is it effortful or is it effortless? When you're really with someone that you love being with and you're just hanging out with them, is it effort or effortless? I don't know. It's effort and it's effortless. We move beyond the idea of I'm making effort to just being with it, just being alive with it, just to picking up on its energy, its form, its color. And if it's got some negative stuff, just being able to incorporate that from the person without making a big deal out of it, from the object, from the activity. And the fifth one is meditation, dhyana, D-H-Y-A-N-A. And we are the meditation school of Buddhism. Zen means meditation, 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 meditation. But if it's a paramita, meditation? Oh, we're trying so hard to do our meditation. How many minutes a day of meditation are you doing? How many are you doing? You better ask her how many she's doing. You want to do as many as her because she hasn't even been sitting as long as you. How many retreats have you done? I'm going to ask you, and you're going to tell me, if you haven't done a retreat, you're missing out. You can never get this. So you better do some retreats. I'm doing a retreat. I'm leading a retreat on March 23rd. So you guys should all come. That's the one true way. Come to my retreat, and then you'll really learn how to meditate. Meditation, meditation, meditation. And everybody gets stressed out about meditating. Am I meditating enough? Tim, how much should I be meditating? Tim, this retreat freaks me out. Maybe I shouldn't do a retreat because it doesn't help me meditate. I meditate less in the retreat. I just think more while I'm in the retreat. What should I do, Tim? What should you do? Meditation has to include no meditation. Forget about it. Don't get obsessed by the idea of meditating. Don't get fixated on it. And if you notice you're fixated on it, because it's a desire you have. Yes, I get fixated on my grandkids because I really want to be with them. But then if I'm fixated on them too much, I don't enjoy being. If I'm fixated too much on how much meditation I'm going to do in the next month, then I'm not available. Then I'm not alive to just you as you are, right here, right here. Always right here, always right here. So, no meditation. But you don't have to kick out meditation. That includes meditation. Because if you don't worry about that, then you become more meditative. You just notice things more. You notice things more. You're more still inside. You're more quiet. You're more available to this wonder of life, this snow and this wind that's passing through without pissing and moaning about it. Just, oh, there it is. And then maybe you are pissing and moaning, and you're just letting the pissing and moaning come in with the wind and pass with the wind. Woohoo! Right? So, being where we are. Nothing exists as a separate entity. Everything's interconnected. So where we are is where all life is. So all life is here. Wow. Wow. And the last one, wisdom. The last one, prajna. Jna, jnana in Sanskrit. J-N-A-N-A, which means to know. To know. We want to know. You want to know what Tim's talking about. You want to know what Ben's talking about in his book. I have to read the whole thing to find out, but it's tough. No, but prajna is before know. P-R-A means before in Sanskrit. So it means before knowing. Prajna. Before knowledge. So what happened to Adam and Eve? Adam and Eve were having a good time, just being, right? Then they ate that apple. What was that apple? What did that apple have in it? Knowledge of good and evil. Dichotomy. Polarity. Immediately they got stuck on one-sidedness. Immediately they got stuck. And then civilization ever after got stuck. And then you guys who are Christians were all original, are all sinners. I don't know. I didn't grow up in that. But some of you know how sinful you've been, right? Luckily, I escaped from that one. Dichotomous thinking, right? So, in the Blue Cliff Lefferts, Dijang asked his student Fa Yan, "Where are you going?" Fa Yan said, "I am wandering aimlessly." "What do you think of wandering?" said his teacher. "I don't know," said Fa Yan. "Not knowing is most intimate," said the teacher. The great intimacy of not having to know, not having to eat the apple. Well, you've ate the apple once, but you don't have to eat it again, do you? You ate it twice. You ate it all those years you did Christian practice. Now, you don't need to eat it anymore, you guys. You don't need to eat it. So instead of trying to sustain a state of mind, be generous, be moral, be patient, you don't know, you don't need to know. This is not Descartes, I don't know, in which he's just, you can tell his brain is all, he's all stressed out at his head trying to know. This is, I don't know. Wow. Wow. Isn't it cool? Isn't it cool? So we sink so deeply into don't know that we can just be. Instead of worrying about being a sinner or about our identity or trying to be someone, we can settle into some sense that all life's supporting us right here, right now. Always it's supporting us. And then we want to support it back because it's everything is happening this way, always just happening. So, in Buddhism, we don't have original sin. What do we have? We have original ignorance. Original ignorance. Avidya, no seeing. V-I-D-Y-A, seeing. Ah, without. No original ignorance. And our original ignorance is a little sexist, which is not so surprising, because all the schemas that I've read about the 12-fold chain of dependent co-origination, it starts with the grandmother losing her sight. She loses her sight, she's blind, and now she's a blind grandmother, so she's lost her sight. She no longer feels connected. Instead of eating the apple and becoming a sinner, she loses her sight. So she feels disconnected from the world, she feels scared, she tries then to create a world to support her that she feels separate from. And the 12-fold chain of dependent co-origination is all about how we get stuck on that path, how we repeat it over and over and over again in our lives. But we can step off it by seeing, by vidya, by seeing. So, moving from avidya, from ignorance, to seeing, vidya being the same root as vision, vidya, V-I-S, we can do it by penetrating these levels of attention that overlay our natural ability to see clearly. Because we have a natural ability to see clearly. And we overlay it with ideas, images, memories, evaluations. And we spend most of our time squandering our attention on this surface level stuff, don't we? And then underneath those, or you could say underneath, I suppose, are our instinctual urges that we're unaware of and yet have a lot of force and drive in our lives. And so much force and so much drive that they keep us from feeling connected, because we want this, we need this. But we see these, we know they're instinctual, and we know that they're never going to go away, but we don't have to be preyed upon by them. We don't have to be preyed upon by them. And then our moods, which are more subtle and long-lasting. And we're unaware of how much our moods influence us. So yesterday, the first thing that happened when I woke up in the morning was that I had a cold. I don't have a cold. It's gone away really fast. But I had a cold day before yesterday. And yesterday, it was really kind of bad. I just wanted to stay in bed. And so that affected my mood, especially since I knew I had to give the Dharma talk here today. And then I thought, oh, I have to give the Dharma talk. You know, I've got a cold. And then there's going to be all the snow. And then I thought, how am I going to get here? Because my alley, nobody plows my alley. And my car's in the garage. It affected my mood all day. But I saw it. I was with it. I sat with it. I breathed with it. And it didn't prey on me. These moods just come. They come from our circumstances, from our lives. And it's part of being human. But they don't need to prey. We don't need to prey. They don't need to prey on us if we just see them. If we just open to them. Oh, there it is. And it's circumstances. My cold, thinking how I was going to get here in the morning. Did I already tell you guys how I got here? Yeah. Just like old-time Minnesota. Minnesota used to be like this. We used to tromp around in our sorrels all the time. We never took our sorrels off. Younger people don't even know what sorrels are, probably. It was fun. Oh, not always, but a lot of time fun. Because we just did it. You just did it. That's all. So if we can become familiar in a non-critical, non-judgmental way with these layers and the feeling tones that they're in the body, they're feeling tones, all kinds of feeling tones in the body. As the mind slows down, and if it doesn't slow down, as it opens up, because if you do meditation, it's either going to slow down or open up. And some people say, oh, my mind will never slow down. I say, well, that's okay, but there's always a space between every thought. Even the space is only this big. Open up to that space. So as the mind slows down, as the mind opens up, some clarity arises. And the mind naturally frees itself. And naturally then there's some vidya. There's some seeing. Some clear seeing in which it's not Tim seeing Faru, it's a really clear seeing where there's no subject and object. But it is a subject and object, but there's just not hung up on it. It's so clear that we're not hung up on the subject and object. But we don't ever get rid of the subject and object because conventional reality, subject and object reality is the world we live in. They're really important. So generosity, stinginess, morality, immorality, patience, impatience, meditation, no meditation, undivided. And that's what wisdom is, before we divide things up. Having said that, I want to remind you that as human beings, we always divide things up, and dividing things up is important and can be fun, but don't get all wigged out by it. It's just something the human organism does. But since human beings do get wigged out by it, everybody has to come to my next retreat on March 23rd and sit the whole 2 days. You can't just sit for one day. So I think I will end with that and see if there are any questions. Anybody have any questions? Or comments? Yeah.
I was just like thinking about this. So like sometimes I notice myself either trying to plan for the future or like sometimes my planning crosses into worrying. And I was just wondering if you had any comments on like how to tell when your planning crosses into worrying and sort of.
When
you're like trying to plan for the future,
yeah,
crosses into worrying about it.
Yeah. Well, as much as possible, when it's, you need to plan. Don't do anything else. Just plan. If you completely plan, then you can let go of it after you've planned. You don't have to worry. You don't have to come back to it again. Or maybe you come back to it once, and then you'll plan some more. But planning is important. This isn't, Zen is not about, we're not the non-planning school of the Buddhism. But usually, we get all mixed up, you know. We get obsessed with kind of doing it right and planning it so it'll come out right, and then we gotta go over and over and over again. And then we say, oh, I shouldn't be planning, I should just be sitting in meditation. But as much as possible, when the time comes to plan, just plan. And don't do anything else. For years, I sat here every morning, really early in the morning. I don't know if we should be sitting here so early in the morning. No, well, the reason is that not, huh? What'd you say?
Preach.
Yeah. I don't know. We sit here early in the morning because they did that in monasteries. And then we started doing it because people have jobs. But you know, almost nobody comes to sit here early in the morning. Except moi and Anne and Ben occasionally, Ben twice a week. So I'm wondering, should we be sitting later in the mornings? That's just why did I even get into that? I can't remember what we were talking. Well, this is a question. I was talking about planning. Oh yeah, so I used to sit here really early in the mornings, then I would get to my office where I directed a very large nonprofit, and I spent my first half hour of my day planning. I just would plan. I would do nothing but plan. People would say, oh, you're a Zen teacher. You should... What do they think a Zen teacher does? Duh. They have some silly idea about a Zen teacher. I would plan. And I would do it wholeheartedly for a half hour, and then I'd just do my day after that. Pretty much.